be back home. Always is. I'll be back with my family. And we're very delighted for our guests. We appreciate your presence. And trust and hope that our worship together today has honored God as we have looked upon Him and thought of heavenly and spiritual things. And we have a couple of very special guests in our audience today with us, Matt Dickinson and Nathan Bradley. They come from Houston. And Matt is a fellow, two-time Jamaican traveler. He is currently studying in the University of Houston with a degree in hotel and motel management with a minor in Arabic, with an interest in international travel and ultimately preaching and teaching overseas. And he is going to be preaching for us this afternoon, and I'd like to encourage you to come back and to listen to him as he brings the thoughts from the Word of God. For most of us, the very existence of God is obviously not a problem. We have just exalted His name in song. We readily admit and accept not only His existence, but we also accept that the Bible is God's special revelation to man. However, that isn't true in our society. In our more and more increasingly secular society, discussions among friends become a revelation that many of them have become rather skeptical about the very existence of God. It's interesting that Paul says in Romans 1 that the skeptic is really without excuse. He says in verses 19 and 20, because what they have known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Here Paul reasons from the standpoint and viewpoint of intelligent design. He says, we look at those things that are created, and by looking at the creation, then they indeed manifest and demonstrate the marvelous design of this universe, demonstrate that indeed there is a God, though we've never seen Him. They reveal very clearly the divine power. Now, often when we get into this discussion about the existence of God, offering evidence, there are four classical arguments that I want to look at this morning. Then I want to look at the merits and demerits of each one of those. And then I want to come back to the question or the statement, if there is no God, then what? First of all, the first argument is the ontological argument, which basically means that the very concept of God proves His existence. The idea is that according to St. Anselm, back in the second century, he reasoned and said that the very fact that man can conceive of God in his mind is a demonstration that there is indeed a God. There was a French philosopher by the name of Descartes who also refined this argument. And he reasoned that the idea of an infinite perfect being can exist in the mind of man only if that being exists in reality. In other words, there's no way for us to conceive in our mind of something that doesn't exist. We'll talk about the merits and demerits of this argument in a minute. The second argument is the cosmological argument. This argument says that our very existence demands a first cause. That is, we say, well, we're here. Although a few years ago, you know, I was talking to a fella, and I said, you know, we're here, and he wasn't sure if we were or not. So I said, well, pinch yourself, and you'll realize that you indeed are in existence. We are here. And therefore, by the very fact that we are here, and the very fact that we exist, then we have, obviously, with effect, the need of a cause. And basically, we boil this argument down to two possibilities. That first cause was either eternal matter, or that first cause was eternal mind. And of course, then we ask the question, which is more reasonable? To believe that the first cause that brought all of this into existence, is it more reasonable to believe that it was eternal mind or eternal matter? The third argument is the teleological argument. It argues from the point of design. That is, if there is design, there must be a designer. The Greek word teleos basically means end or purpose or aim. For example, the old argument about the watch. We understand that the watch has a reason, has a purpose, it has a design. And therefore, if there is a design, then there must be a designer. And we look at this very complex natural world that we live in, and we see the great design in this complex natural world. And therefore, we reason that behind the design, there must be a designer. The fourth argument is the moral argument. The idea is that man's very sense of right or wrong demands a moral governor. The reality is that while man is a very cruel creature, at the same time, in almost every human race, almost every civilization, even though some may be a little more barbaric than what we think of, the fact is that in every civilization, every human, among all the civilizations of man, there is this sense of right and wrong. There is a moral ought. And so the question is that if the human race is the product of natural forces, then what is the source of man's moral awareness? Would it be more reasonable to think that his moral awareness would come from dead matter? Or would it be more reasonable to believe that man's sense of ought, moral awareness comes from a creator? And we'll talk about that in a minute. So having looked at these four classical arguments, let's make an application of them. First of all, consider with me the ontological argument. What are the strengths of the ontological argument? Well, I'm just going to say none. I realize that, you know, we could argue this, and I'm, you know, if you want to talk about it, that's fine. But basically, I would say that there are not very many strengths to this argument. And there are certainly a number of weaknesses. Number one, the argument is too abstract to understand. And number two, it isn't based upon empirical and observable evidence. That is, not based upon evidence that we can observe. Therefore, I think this argument maybe has some merit, but nonetheless, it wouldn't be the first one that I would deal with in trying to demonstrate to the skeptic that there is a God. But then when it comes to the cosmological argument, I would think that there is some merit to it. Number one, it is a conclusion that is based upon facts. First cause. We're here. We are in existence. And therefore, the effect would suggest that indeed there must have been some kind of cause. And not only that, but this idea, the cosmological argument is biblically based. In fact, the very first verse of the Bible, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," basically assumes something. That in the beginning of time, Jamie pointed that out in the class this morning, there was a timeless being, God, who was the eternal being, the first cause, who created, and basically the Hebrew word there says, the word bara means that he created something from nothing. God, the Bible concludes, is that first cause. And in the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and in verse 3, in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 3, the Hebrew writer says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of the things which are visible." By faith we understand that God, that eternal being, was the first cause, and he made the things that are in, framed the world so that the things which are seen are not made of the things which are visible. So what are the weaknesses of this cosmological argument? Well, actually, as far as I'm concerned, there are none, but I would suggest one. And the question is commonly raised, well, if there must be a first cause, then who caused that first cause? That is, if God is the, or maybe you're in conversation, and we say, well, you know, Jehovah God, we believe, is that first cause. And the question is, well, who made God? Who made him? Actually, I think this is a rather weak argument. Because you can throw the question back at them and say, well, then if the first cause is matter, then who made the matter? I don't know how many of you have seen the new movie Expelled, Ben Stein. I would suggest you go see it. Great movie, good movie. A lot of good stuff there. And literally makes a fool out of some of what I call these egg-headed professors that deemed themselves to be rather intellectual. And the question is a simple question that my son asked his sixth grade science teacher many, many years ago. Where did the matter come from? Who made that? And the question is asked, and they say, well, you know, the Big Bang. No, that's not the point. Where did the original matter come from? So we have a choice here. If the first cause then also had a cause, then with the infinite regress, we could suggest that it was matter that made matter that made matter. Or we could go and say there was a God who made a God who made a God. Or we can simply believe, as the Bible very well suggests, that there was an eternal first cause. What about the theological argument? Well, first of all, there are a number of strengths to this argument. Number one, it is a conclusion based on facts. We certainly understand and can look into our world today and recognize that there is indeed design in every place that we look, in our human body, in the life cycle itself, in the world, in the cosmos, in the stars. And not only that, but this is a very biblical argument. The psalm said, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork." When I think of handiwork, I think of my mom when she would sit down at a sewing machine and put together a dress or a shirt, or the knitting that she would do, and she would make a beautiful afghan. By a much larger scale, our powerful Creator, by His very hands, has made the things that we see and the things that we enjoy. There is indeed design in this world, and behind the design, there must have been a designer. So what are the weaknesses of this argument? Well, again, I think it's a really worthless one, but we'll suggest that the weakness is that someone will say, who designed the super designer? If God was the super designer, then who made Him? If God is the one who designed this world, then who made God? The reality is that infinite regress is not the issue. Either something always has been, or the only other possibility is that something came from nothing. And we believe, of course, that God, the eternal being who always was the one who created this world. The fourth argument is the moral argument. And it has some strength because it is also a conclusion that is based upon fact. The fact is that first of all, human beings all over the earth have this curious idea of ought, of moral law, a sense of moral law. That is, that they ought to behave in a certain way. And secondly, human beings all over the world realize that many times they do not behave according to that standard. In fact, Romans 2, Paul alludes to that, referring to the Gentiles who did not have the old law. He says they are a law unto themselves. There was in man this sense of right and wrong. It is true that many times he doesn't act consistently with that law. It is true that there are various standards according to society, according to various nationalities. Some people may behave a little more barbaric than others, but the reality is that man does have in himself this sense of right and wrong, and we suggest that it indeed did come from God. Now, the weakness is, again, I think, another weak argument. Some would suggest, well, what about all the atrocities that are committed in the name of God? What about David Koresh, who committed all of these terrible things in the name of Christ? What about the cult out in West Texas and all the horrible things that these people do in the name of God? My answer would be, on what basis can an atheist declare anything to be an atrocity? What's his standard? Upon what basis can an atheist claim anything to be evil or good? What is his standard? For he has no standard. So we find four classic arguments, three of them that I believe certainly have merit in suggesting and offering evidence concerning the very evidence of God. But let's go back to our original statement. If there is no God, then what? Number one, if there is no God, there is no explanation for life. You know, the reality is that our human body is a very, very complex and wonderful piece of machinery. For example, the brain unscrambles thousands of electrical messages from the ear, transforming them into meaningful sound. The ear also detects motion and coordinates with the nervous system and muscular system to help us maintain our balance. And each waking second, the eye sends some 1 billion pieces of fresh information to the brain. The result is the ability of the eye to perceive about 10 million different shades of light and over 7 million different shades of color. And that's just the eye and just the ear. And God put it all together where this wonderful body, amazing, incredible human body, works in a very wonderful and marvelous way. But the atheist explanation of that is dumb luck. That's what he says. His explanation is spontaneous generation, that there was this non-living goop out there, and that somehow life just sort of, by chance, came from this non-living substance, which basically is a violation, by the way, of one of the very basic laws of biology, the law of biogenesis, which says that life can only come from another living being. But that's his alternative. If there is no God, there is no real explanation for life. But furthermore, if there is no God, there is no purpose for life. I have no reason to live without God. I don't know how people live without God. Emotionally. I realize emotionally and feelings don't suggest anything or prove anything, but I don't know how people live without God. That if we're just here by coincidence, that it's time plus chance plus matter equals life, that if we're just the result of dumb luck, that is, if we have no design, then we have no purpose. I know some of you have seen the little silly gadget that I have called the Hooey Stick. What it is a little stick, and on the end of it, it has little notches in the stick, and at the end of it, it has a nail, and on that nail is a little propeller that turns, and there's another little stick that comes with it about 2 inches long, and you can take that stick and rub it on the Hooey Stick, and because of static electricity, it will make that propeller turn either in one direction or the other. Now, it doesn't have a great deal of value other than entertainment, but it does have a purpose. And obviously, it has a designer. Someone made that silly little toy that I have somewhere in a drawer that I can't find anymore. It had a reason. It had a purpose. And man was made for a reason. You know, in the 8th Psalm, in Psalm 8 and beginning with verse 3, the psalmist said, "When I consider your heaven, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him and the son of man that you visit him? For you made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, even the beast of the field, the bird of the air, and the fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the sea." God made man the crown jewel of his creation and gave him a very special reason to live. Solomon sums it up in Ecclesiastes, the 12th chapter. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verses 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." Now, which is a better model? You know, we talk a lot in our society about self-esteem. You tell me, which is a better model for self-esteem? To believe we have no reason to be here, no design and no purpose, or that we were made in the likeness of our Father,
with a sense of accountability to that Creator, which lifts us up, brings us to a higher plane? Which model? I know you know the answer. It is the model that is presented in the Bible, that God said that I made man, and I made him for a very special reason. But number three, if there is no God, there is no standard to live by. If we're made by imperfect forces, then to who are we amenable? It becomes nothing more than the jungle code. I was trying to find a quotation that was in the movie the other day from Charles Darwin in The Descent of Man, which is just a very revealing statement about morality. I couldn't find it, so I didn't put it in the lesson today. But the reality is that, for example, we abort millions of babies. I mean, after all, if we're just here for no reason, then, you know, we're no better than the fly or the gnat, right? That is, we lower the value even of human life. I would suggest in this country that in the 1700s, we killed the Bible. In the 1800s, we killed God. And in the 1900s, we killed man. This idea of skepticism and unbelief has been in our society, a planted seed in our world for a very, very long time, even in America. But the Bible offers a very rational and very consistent system of values, of truth and productivity and of compassion, of forgiving and honesty and purity. The Bible teaches us how to live and why we are to live that way. But without God, there is no standard of right and wrong. Number four, without God, there's no eternity for which to live. We just live and die, live and die, live and die. Extinction is the hope of the atheist. He has no purpose. Eons of evolution lead to nothing. In fact, let me share this quotation with you that came from National Geographic in June of 1983. It says, "When primitive man gazed at the void of heaven, his eye discerned at most a few thousand stars, a serene and limited universe. But now, far beyond the range of feeble sight, science has revealed a universe of unimaginable size. From the vastness beyond the congregations of stars comes the murmur of the most cataclysmic event of all, the Big Bang of creation." Well, what came before the Big Bang, and how will it end? Billions of years hence, will gravity overcome the expansion and pull all matter back into a big crunch? Or will ever an expanding universe end in a whimper? It's galactically scattered irretrievably, their star fire spinning cold. For now, the questions are the domain of the philosopher as well as the astronomer. Is that how you want to live? You want to live with no eternity, no hope, no possibility? Just extinction. That when you die, you're just dead like Rover all over. You better get on with enjoying this world, because there's nothing after that. But the Bible very plainly tells us that it is appointed that a man wants to die. After this, the judgment. And no one will miss that appointment. After this, two possible eternal destinies. Either eternal life or eternal condemnation. And Jesus Christ is the only way and the only hope that we have to be redeemed from sin and to be given the life gift that God offers. He's the only way. I don't know, maybe you believe that. But I'm going to tell you something. God made us for a very special reason. He did not make us to defile ourselves and defile our bodies, but He made us to live holy lives and pure lives, God-honoring lives in His presence. God loved us enough that He gave us the means and the ability to do that through the gift of His Son, that we might be forgiven and might be given the wonderful goal of being His disciple and becoming His child, becoming the very special creature that He wants us to be. Do you believe that? Maybe you do, and maybe today you want to become His child. If there's something we can do today to prepare your life and heart that you might be ready to meet God, to get your life right with Him, if we can do anything today to help you in that way, we would certainly welcome that opportunity. And we invite you now, if you would, to come at this time. Would you come if we stand and sing the song for life?